if I want to do a challenge, physical challenge, just because no one's ever done it before, that's a superficial reason. Doesn't mean I won't do it, but I put that into the box of that superficial. But in reality, I need some strong, deep-rooted whys. Because when everything goes wrong, when I can't get funding, when I'm injured, and when I've committed to something and I have no idea how I'm going to do it, or when I'm in the actual middle of the challenge and everything goes wrong, and I'm in the trenches, what's going to get me out of there? I tell you what, just because I'm the first person to do it, that gives me an out. No one's ever done it before. I don't have to complete it. I can finish it. So I'm gone. But if I have these deep-rooted whys, then they're the things that are going to give me the energy to push me forward.
That's Luke Tyberski, up next on the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to another episode of the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show, which is all about risk and uncertainty, how to understand it and embrace these things in just about any aspect of life and the world in which we live. We have a great episode for you, but before I get into that, a couple of things to let you know about. First, this episode is brought to you by Audible, the home for audiobooks. As a listener to the All Things Risk podcast, you can get a 30-day free trial plus an audiobook, which is yours to keep no matter what. Choose from over 180,000 titles. Take advantage of this simply by going to audibletrial.com/allthingsrisk. That's if you are in the USA. If you are in the UK, click on the link in the show notes. Second, in 2 weeks, I will be running 46 kilometers to commemorate 46 years on this planet. Something called the 46 in 219 is what I'm naming it, and I'm raising money for three charities: Mind, the Battersea Dogs and Cats Home in London, and Médecins Sans Frontières, which is also known as Doctors Without Borders. You can make a donation to any of those three via the link in the show notes. And if you are in London on February the 17th, you can join me for any or all of the 46 kilometers. This is a challenge that was inspired by today's guest, who, by the way, will be joining me for all of the 46 in 219. Who is this wonderful person? His name is Luke Tyberski, who is making his second appearance on the show. Luke is an ultra-endurance athlete, an adventurer, a speaker, a coach, and an author. And if you listened way back to episode 9 of the All Things Risk podcast, you know that Luke completed this crazy adventure called the Ultimate Triathlon, which involved swimming across the Strait of Gibraltar from Morocco to Spain, cycling along the coast of Spain, and then running along southern France into Monaco, over 2,000 kilometers in 12 days. And the Ultimate Triathlon is now the subject of an award-winning documentary. And prior to all of this, Luke was an aspiring but journeyman footballer, and we get into all of that. However, there is a deeper, more interesting, raw, and inspiring side to Luke and his work. For years, Luke concealed a diagnosis of clinical depression, and it's only very recently that he shared how he persevered through some of the darkest moments in his life. In his new book, Chasing Extreme, A Journey of Overcoming Obstacles and Depression to Embrace a Life of Extreme Adventure. And I think the message of Chasing Extreme and that Luke brings overall is particularly important to us men. We typically do not acknowledge our feelings, and the longer that that goes on, the more that we can suffer, and the outcomes of all of that are never positive. And Luke is a great role model to inspire us to talk about these things more openly, and I do that at one point in this conversation. And in doing so, I think we all benefit. And I think one of the great things about the message that Luke brings is that we can deal with some of these demons, but still do incredible things and achieve amazing things. And Luke is the embodiment of all of that. And we talk about those things in this conversation, plus the importance of purpose in doing any sort of challenge. We get into managing uncertainty and Luke's future challenges, as well as tons more. Luke is one of my favorite people on this planet. So let's get into it. Here is Luke Tversky. Luke, welcome back to
thanks,
the All Things Earth podcast. This is going to be a huge amount of fun. So thank you. It's wonderful to have you back.
Absolutely. My pleasure, mate. It's great to sit down and chat with you again. A lot has happened since the previous time that we spoke, so I'm excited.
You're one of my favorite people, so it's a pleasure to be able to spend a little bit of time with you. So for my listeners who don't know you at all, who are you? What do you do? Why are you here?
Who am I? That's a question I ask myself every single day. These days, I describe myself as a speaker, an author, because my book just came out couple of weeks ago, which I'm sure we'll get into, and someone who helps inspire growth in individuals. And it's something that I'm really working on over the next few months and years, because I do these ultra big physical challenges and I've learned so much from doing them. And we spoke about a lot in our previous podcast. But I feel I can make an impact in this world by teaching others what life has taught me and enabling others by giving them the mindset processes that I have understood from my own journey and share them to others. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit of a fluffy way of saying I do ultra big challenges, I learn from them, and then I speak and write books and I coach people one-on-one via online and things like that on topics of mindsets, health and wellness, and endurance sports.
Great. We talked about the Ultimate Triathlon the last time you were here, and it was an amazing thing and an amazing feat. And you know, congratulations on that, and also the documentary that came out. Was it last year? It was last year.
No, 2016.
The documentary.
End of 2016.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Time flies.
Yeah, right. And my listeners can listen to that episode, right, to get a little bit more background into who you are and what you do. But I'd be interested in just getting a little bit of the kind of, not just the short version of it, but now that you've had a little bit more time since then, to talk a little bit about, well, what led you to do that? Well, first of all, what was the Ultimate Triathlon and what led you to do these kinds of things?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it has definitely taken me, well, to be honest, probably like 6-7 years to actually understand that. The Ultimate Triathlon was a self-created, first time ever anyone's done this route or even a triathlon of this sort of point-to-point magnitude. I haven't found anyone else that's really done something like this in the form that I created. So it's a swim, bike, run, and originally it was created from Morocco to Monaco, 2,000 kilometers in 12 days. I set this up as a time-framed adventure. Stupidly, I say now. If you watch the documentary, you understand why. But yeah, it was this big goal that I'd set myself about 4 years from an idea that came from staring at a world map to actually standing at the start line, so to speak, about to swim across the Gibraltar Strait. So that's basically what it was. But how I came about that was, I used to be a footballer, we talked about that, soccer, mm-hmm. football, and battled with depression for a long time and kept it a secret, didn't talk to anyone about it. Took me years, probably 3 or 4 years before I even went to talk to a therapist about it, because I was just ashamed. I didn't really want to open up. I didn't really understand. I was completely confused, because here I am, this professional athlete in his mid-20s, winning at life if someone saw it from the outside. But I was struggling. Like, I was barely getting out of bed. I was suicidal thoughts, self-harming thoughts, and all that type of stuff. And then one day after, this is the short version, obviously, you can read all about it in my book. It tells you the longer version. Yeah, trying to get becoming a salesman. It's hard. It's not my natural thing to do, but I'm getting there. It's I had a lot of injuries at the end of my football career, physically and obviously mentally, I touched on. But then I decided to retire and I was like, what's next? I was 28 at the time, didn't really know what I wanted to do in life. And it was a knee-jerk reaction that I thought to myself, I want to try and find something big to get my teeth into. I remember a conversation I had with my friend who just started doing running races in Australia, and he was doing marathons, and I thought he was an absolute nutcase. And I thought, people who do marathons are on a death wish. You know, I was a footballer. I ran like 5Ks at preseason. I thought that was huge. So how everything came about was my friends inspired me inadvertently to do something big. But instead of saying, right, I'm going to run a marathon, I found what's deemed as, depending on the publication you read, as one of the world's toughest endurance challenges, being the Marathon des Sables, 255 kilometers in 7 days running through the Sahara Desert, carrying everything you need in a backpack. Now, where does this fit with the ultimate triathlon? When I signed up to the Marathon des Sables, I thought, right, I'm going to turn this into a career. And this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. I'm going to be, I even gave myself a title. I've still got business cards that I use today with the title, my job title being an endurance adventurer. It means nothing. I made it up. But basically, what that meant to me was I'm going to do these big challenges all around the world. And I'm going to have brands and organizations who are going to sponsor me. I'm going to travel around the world doing these massive big feats. And I'm going to speak all around the world about these challenges. I'm going to write books. And I'm going to write magazine articles in all these different publications. And documentaries are going to be on television. And it's going to be awesome. This is it. Right. This is my life. But to make that reality, I knew something that, where 1,000 people a year, i.e. the Marathon des Sables, did it, that wasn't going to cut it. Like, that wasn't going to put me above everyone else to be this endurance adventurer. So what I thought was, to get back to your why the ultimate triathlon question, was I need to do something big. I need to do something that's going to put me on the map. So I stared at a world map with nothing but adventure in my mind, and what started of, geez, that little bit of water between Africa and Spain doesn't look that very long. Oh, I could swim that. And I have no swimming background. I didn't even own a bike. You know, I'd only just signed up to my first ever running race. And I created the marathon, I created the ultimate triathlon route. And then I thought, I'm going to give myself 4 years to prepare for that. So then in 6 months' time, I ran the Marathon des Sables. And pretty much from then until 4 years later, I filled in with all these things that we spoke about in the previous podcast, living with high up in the rural mountains of Nepal, with ultra runners, running down Mount Everest in the world highest ultra marathon, cycling from London to Newquay, which is 412 kilometers nonstop. Yeah, did a double Ironman triathlon. It was my first ever triathlon. Ran through a tropical forest in China. No food, money, water, didn't speak the language, all that stuff. And then I did the ultimate triathlon. So that was that block of time. And but in reality, like, yes, it was trying to achieve this dream of being an endurance adventurer, and documentaries and magazine articles and books and speaking and sponsorships and all that. That was almost like the curtain, like in The Wizard of Oz. Behind that was this scared guy running away from life, not facing up to the facts that he was battling with depression, didn't want to speak up about it, hiding behind the sort of like the machoness of the ultra endurance challenges I was doing. And I'm telling everyone I'm going to be an endurance adventurer and this is going to be my career, so they won't ask me deep, penetrating questions. No, Luke, like, are you okay? You haven't processed your football career yet. You went from one to another. Are you okay? You know, is everything fine? Like, how are you going to make money in the future? Like, excuse me, these type of questions, no one really asked me because I was deflecting anything that was looking like going to be a conversation that was going to be deep and meaningful about my future, because I was like, I'm going to be an endurance adventurer. Don't bother me with your questions. I don't have time because I've got to train. I've got to pitch this to that. And I've got to pitch this to this person. I've got to try and get sponsorship. So I was running away from life until I got to the ultimate triathlon, and I basically crashed and burned afterwards.
There's a lot there, and we're probably going to start to dive into some of the themes in your book, because one of the things when you were just describing that, I thought, well, that's your life now. You know, you do these adventures, and then you speak about them, and you've written a book, and so that sounds like exactly like you're doing exactly what you set out to do, at a level.
Yeah, no, 100%. It's quite crazy though, because what happened was, I was running away from life, as I said, and then the ultimate triathlon basically pulverized me into the ground. And I don't want to give too much away in the book, but really it was, I talk about ultra endurance sports as I was addicted to them, and the ultimate triathlon was my overdose. Mm. And I had numerous medical ailments and just injuries all over my body because the ultimate triathlon in the previous 4 years just drained me physically, emotionally, mentally. And I didn't do any exercise for 18 months. Mm. So everything we just sort of talked about in our first podcast, I did all that in like 4 years, and then it just drained me. So then the real learning section of my life, and I don't think I've ever learned so much in such a short period of time, i.e. 18 months, when I wasn't able to do exercise because I was struggling to walk because I was exhausted. My adrenal glands weren't secreting different hormones. I was having crazy headaches every morning for like 6 hours. Had to go see a couple of neurologists. I had different scans on my brain. I was having some medication to try and get some electricity firing properly in my brain again. That's sort of the layman's terms of what was going on because my brain wasn't firing properly. And this was causing headaches. And so all this stuff was happening. I had to have these custom-made lozenges because to try and help part of my endocrine system, the DHEA hormone, which is a precursor to testosterone, that wasn't secreting. So my testosterone level was really low, and my growth hormone, which is the DHEA, was really low. So I had to have all this medication to boost that up, natural. But it was in that period of time where I had to actually stop and look at my life and actually say to myself, is this how I want to live? What have I learned from this previous 5 years? Mm. And all the things I speak about now are the things that I've learned from that period of time when I've stopped to reflect on the big challenges.
So much less so what led up to and during the ultimate triathlon, and more the 18 months of consolidating the lessons and reflecting on those.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time reflecting, and I even wrote an ebook about it, just chucked it on my website for free because I realized I went through this process. Mm-hmm. I've stopped looking, listening, asking questions and learning in the process of reflecting.
I
realized I was running away from so much, and I went back to see another therapist. I was doing a lot of work on my mental health as well, and I found my now wife who's just amazing. She does well with putting up with me, but you've met her. She's so not like me. She's like quite happy to stay out of the limelight. She doesn't want to know anyone. Like she's quite happy to stay on the side. But she's just been a massive, massive rock in my life at that period of time. And it's during that period where, like, I was still doing talks during the ultimate triathlon lead up and afterwards, and people would say like, why do you do all this type of stuff? And I would come up with this off-the-cuff answer, you know, something that would satisfy them. But in reality, I wasn't going to say I'm running away from life because I'm scared, I'm battling with depression. I wasn't there yet in my personal journey. But when I stopped and when I actually tried to figure out why I was doing all these challenges, is because I was scared and because I was running away from life. But then the other question came up was like, well how? How do you continually push yourself when your toes nearly fall off in the Marathon des Sables, when you pass out 3 times in the ultimate triathlon? How? And before I was actually forced to stop, I would come off like, yeah, I do this and I do this and I think about that. But during that time of reflection, I actually dug deep and went, well, how do I? What goes through my mind? How do I prepare for these challenges? Is there a process that I go through? Mm-hmm. And I actually found certain things, certain reoccurring themes that I actually think about in the lead up of a big challenge or even just a big goal that I want to set, not just physically, but in other areas of my business. And then there's things that I think about in the moment, and there's things that I think about when I'm really, really struggling. It's like, okay, I need to dig deep here. And I realize there's these reoccurring things. So now when people say, why, I totally understand why I do what I do now. And
how do you answer that question?
That's the sole purpose of before I make a decision now is why. And I look at why as two levels, superficial and deep-rooted. So superficial in the purest, especially in this day and age, people think superficial and non-authentic and things like this, but I mean it in the purest sense of the word. It's just sort of stuff on the surface. So if I want to do a challenge, physical challenge, just because no one's ever done it before, that's a superficial reason. Doesn't mean I won't do it, but I put that into the box of that superficial. Mm-hmm. But in reality, I need some strong, deep-rooted whys. Because when everything goes wrong, when I can't get funding, when I'm injured, and when I've committed to something and I have no idea how I'm going to do it, or when I'm in the actual middle of the challenge and everything goes wrong and I'm in the trenches, what's going to get me out of there? I tell you what, just because I'm the first person to do it, that gives me an out. No one's ever done it before. I don't have to complete it. Mm-hmm. I can finish it. So I'm gone. Mm-hmm. But if I have these deep-rooted whys, then they're the things that are going to give me the energy to push me forward. And I have this quote, and it's, clarity is the eternal energy that fuels your dreams. So if you're so clear and knowing why you want to do what you do, that will give you the energy to push you forward to achieve whatever you want. But you've got to be crystal clear, and it starts with those deep-rooted whys. And the analogy that I'd love to give your listeners is this. What you want to achieve is like a tree trunk. Okay, the superficial whys are the branches and the leaves more specifically. They come and go in the seasons. They look beautiful in the autumn, and also the tree looks amazing in the summer with the green leaves, and they're great. But what happens when it's really windy? Leaves go blow away, and they go off, and the seasons change, and they go off, and they come back. But what doesn't change? The roots. They take time to penetrate into the soil, to ground the trunk, to really stay strong. So gale force winds come through, branches come down, leaves disappear, the trunk gets hammered, but the roots are so strong it can weather any storm, and it holds it into the ground. That's your deep-rooted why. So your trunk can get bigger and grow, and the tree can grow. But the branches and the leaves, they'll come and go. They're your superficial why, and the roots are the deep-rooted ones. So whenever I do a big challenge now, I literally will go down with a notepad and go, why am I doing this? Why do I truly want to do this? And if it's all superficial whys, it's all leaves, most of the time, I don't do it. But if there's some really deep-rooted whys that really get me excited, like you can hear it in my voice now, I'm excited to talk about this because it's something that I love speaking about. If I get excited about those deep-rooted whys for a challenge or a business idea or anything, I know that's like, okay, step one is done.
I love that. That's so awesome. I've been thinking a lot about decision-making over the last few months, and I haven't landed on the overall approach to my own philosophy, but the first one is to know yourself, the first step. I'm trying to order my thoughts around decision making, but the first thing is know yourself and your why as you discuss it. Because when things do get tough, then it will, you know, that the why will see you through.
Yeah, and the other thing that I have is a life philosophy, you know, and Michael Gervais, who we spoke about off air, who's, you know, Finding Mastery podcast and just very intelligent guy. Him and Pete Carroll, coach of the Seattle Seahawks in the NFL. They work together in numerous ways, and they talk about having it's not a life philosophy, but I think a personal statement. And Pete Carroll challenges people to create that in 25 words or less. And you might think, oh, that's easy. A guiding set of principles or words or sentences of what you live by every single day. Now, when you actually stop and try and write down, how do I want to live my life every single day? Not for business, not for personal, not for like athletic, your entire life, 25 words. I tell you what, the first time I did it, it took me a whole notebook. You know, I wrote a whole like a thesis on it. But over time, I whittled it down. And the great thing is it can evolve. It's not static. It's not set in stone. And it can evolve over time. And I started doing this probably in 2013, 2014. And right now, where I'm at in life, I've got it down. I think it's 11 words. Okay? It's learn daily and teach others what life has taught me.
Love it.
So if you think about this, when I get up in the morning and there's a decision to be made on where I'm going to spend my time, because that's the only thing we have. We have time, right? And there's 1,440 minutes in every single day. So if there comes a decision that someone's going to steal my time or I'm going to give my time to someone, I think, can I learn from this or can I teach others? And that's the decision made simple. So tonight, you asked me to come on this podcast, literally on the other side of London to where I live. Partially, yeah, because you're a mate and I love chatting with you. But if it was someone who I didn't even know before and they invited me on to their podcast, I would go, okay, it's going to take me an hour and a half to get here, an hour and a half to get home. I'm going to chat for an hour. That's my whole afternoon, evening done. If someone just who I didn't know, who just, I don't know, invited me for a coffee, I wouldn't necessarily come and do it, but I know that I will learn from this podcast by chatting with you, even talking about my own story and us going back and forth about things, I will learn something. But the flip side to that is I'm pretty confident and I'm going to teach you or your listeners something to go and think about. Mm-hmm. It might not be life-changing or world-changing, but it's going to be something that just might start the ball rolling, plant a seed for them to think. And for me, that's worth my time to come here and teach them what life has taught me. So my life philosophy is just something that I think about every single day when I make decisions when it's going to take up my time. So then when I have that life philosophy down pat like I do now, and I keep that in mind when I'm creating my superficial wires and my deep-rooted wires, creating the roots and the tree leaves, then choosing a big challenge and knowing why I do these big challenges or a new business venture or something like that, You can get rid of all the crap really quickly and then go, oh, right, okay, we've got two avenues here to go down. Let's choose A or B and dig into that a little bit deeper.
Yeah. This I love that. There's so much great stuff, and obviously very honored that you're here and we're going to learn. One of the things I did want to just touch on, and I want to also get into some of the themes of your book, but that is the fact to me, endurance sport is a teacher. And when you're doing something that's really difficult, actually anything that's difficult is a teacher, but endurance sport, particularly when you're doing something that's just a little bit beyond your reach, maybe a lot beyond your reach where you think it is, then you learn something. So even though you entered these challenges with a certain idea, oh, I'm going to complete this thing, I'm going to be this adventure, these superficial reasons, actually the endeavor turned around to you and then said, no, I'm going to teach you something. I'm going to give you some lessons. I'm going to impart some wisdom. And that's what I love about endurance sport, because it's you go into that uncertainty and then you come out the other end and it's like, well, that either didn't go according to plan or whatever, but I've learned something that I wouldn't have known otherwise. And it's so awesome that way. Is that?
Yeah. If you want to learn and grow, do difficult things.
Yeah.
And endurance sports are difficult. Bottom line. I didn't learn anything in reality. Well, I didn't learn anything from a broader perspective for 5 years because I had my head down chasing these superficial wires that I want to have this amazing life. Don't get me wrong. I was not driven by money. It was driven by the fact that I thought it would be cool. And I'll quote
it
myself
cool.
back then.
It is cool.
I thought it would be cool to live this life of doing all that. And the most crazy, I think, I don't know, maybe you can call it oxymoron, is I wanted to do all this stuff, right? And I wanted to be able to live a comfortable life and do all these things. But at the same time, I didn't want to be famous. I wanted to be able to go to my local coffee shop and no one knew me. I know that doesn't make any sense. And it's impossible. If I'm going to speak around the world and I'm going to be on television with these documentaries and write books and do all that, I know that I'm going to get recognized on the street. But for me, it was not about the fame. It was not about the money, because I wanted to just be able to live a normal life and walk past people and no one knows me. But I still thought it'd be cool to do all this stuff. So for 5 years, I was basically chasing sort of that life, but it wasn't until I was forced to stop. So endurance sports broke me, because it was basically sort of saying, okay, now you've got to face up to life.
Yeah.
And it was that time where I needed to sort of really understand what was going on inside of me, get to know me better, talk about my mental health, understand that. And then also that's when I really learned, you know, so it's that whole stress versus rest equals growth equation. You know, stress can be anything. It can be a difficult job. It can be a project that you're doing. It can be physical exertion. It can be mental exertion, you know, like a chess player. They're sitting on their bum and they're moving their arm a little bit. But if they're constantly playing someone better than them, okay, the stress is that they're getting beat every time. And if they take a moment to actually reflect, could be mid-move, it could be mid-game, it could be post-game, even talking to the person they're beating against, why did you do that? Understand. So they have that stress where they're actually getting beaten on the chessboard, that time to sort of rest, i.e. reflection, recovery, whatever, and then they can grow if they're open-minded to it, you know. Otherwise, they're just going to say, no, I'm going to beat them, and you're not going to learn. Mm. But if you want to truly grow, do difficult things, i.e. put yourself under stress, but then when things happen, you need that time of rest or recovery, call it what you want, and then that enables growth. And if people continue to put themselves in difficult situations or stress, and then they actually take the time to understand what happened during that process, or like I love failing, I look at failure as a positive as long as you're still breathing. Always got to say that caveat. Because if you fail at something and you reflect, you gain knowledge. And you use that knowledge with more hard work, gives you the best chance to succeed. That's just another way of that whole stress, rest, recovery and growth equation. So it took me like 5 years to actually properly stop and recover and rest or reflect, however you want to call it, during those 18 months where I did no exercise, before I all of a sudden realized, hang on, I do go through these processes during my adventures. I do go through this process when I create these adventures, when I had these whys, these deep-rooted ones. I just was so focused on the superficial ones. Mm. I didn't realize the deep-rooted whys were growing. I didn't even look down there. I just looked at the pretty leaves, so to speak. Mm. And it was not until then that I actually realized that, wow, these adventures, this sport that I've been doing has taught me about endurance and sports and all the rest of it, but also about life, also about myself. And now I speak across a range of industries, you know, people that don't care about sport. I'm not going to lie. Mm. And they get just as much out of it as if I speak at a running show or a triathlon club or anything like that. It's because of the principles that I've learned are transferable across all industries, because it's not about sport. It's about growth, personal or team growth. And if you want to progress in life, if you want to achieve anything, then that's what you should be doing. You should be looking for opportunities to grow as a person. Yeah. And that's me. That's my brand essence, inspiring growth. But my life philosophy is to learn daily and teach others what life has taught me. And that sums up.
You mentioned this idea of chasing this lifestyle. Is that what you meant by chasing extreme? Is that where the title of the book comes from?
No, the title of the book is Chasing Extreme, and I was chasing this lifestyle. No one's ever put that together, me either. So I could say yes, of course. Makes total sense. You can claim that one. Yeah. I think inadvertently, probably yes, but the reason why I decided with Chasing Extreme was I was constantly chasing something in life during this.
Something outside of yourself.
Yeah, I like right back from as a kid, you know, like I played professional football. I didn't play in the Premier League. I didn't play in any first division anywhere in the world. I played in 4 different countries. I made really no money from football. I didn't retire and, you know, have houses and this and that, whatever. I just got by, basically. So my job was kick a ball around and it paid the bills, but it's not like I was saving loads of cash. But even when I was a kid, I wasn't the first one picked. I was a grinder. I was always the hardest worker in the team. Or if I wasn't the hardest worker, I became friends and really close with the guys who were, and we worked hard together, you know. So that was my way of building myself up. In terms of like the chasing thing, I was always trying to be a footballer. So I was always chasing that next club. I was always chasing a better league. You know, if I was playing in the third division, I wanted to play in the second division because I believed I could. So I was willing to put the work in and dedicate my life to that, which mm-hmm. I did. You know, I moved out of home at 16. I left Australia for the USA when I was 21. My teenage years, compared to a lot of teenagers, was really boring because all I did was train and play soccer. That was it. Mm. I didn't go out and drink and do drugs and experiment and whatever. Yeah. That was it. And I loved it. I wouldn't change it for the world. But so I was always constantly chasing things in life. And then when I retired, like even when finances were dire and even when I had no clubs to go to and I was sleeping on friends of friends' couches or second cousins' daughters' couches, to be specific, you know, in the UK that I'd never met before. And one time missing a late train and had to sleep on a train station platform, you know, because I had no money, I couldn't get a taxi, I had nowhere to go. Where I was going to stay that night was 100 miles away and this is the last train. It didn't bother me. It didn't faze me. I was chasing that next club. And then when I started doing endurance sports, inadvertently, I was chasing that lifestyle. But in reality, I was chasing this answer to the question of who is Luke and what does he want out of life. But I didn't know that I didn't have to chase after it. I didn't know that it was here and I just needed to stop. I needed to stop chasing. So my whole life has been chasing something that is so extreme that it's not really there, you know. And when people read the book, they'll understand why we chose it, because I'm pushing myself all the time, trying to get that next thing, trying to achieve that next level, and not worrying about the injuries or the setbacks or anything else that happened in my life. I was pushing that to the side and nothing was going to stop me. And the way that I chased was extreme. That's the other side of it. So it just fitted really perfectly that there were so many different elements that why we chose those two words, because friends and someone, Jane O'Connell, who helped formulate the book. So I would basically, I wrote the manuscript and basically she turned, like she helped sort of chisel it and edit it and said, write a bit more here, we're going to get rid of that and do this. And but I actually sat down and wrote 150,000 words, I think it was. Wow. It's not that long now. I think it's 100. Yeah. It's 100,000 words. It's still a long book, but it's not like an encyclopedia. So we worked together and we just wrote. We knew the book had to have two words for a title because we just thought that's the type of book it is. And we all the stuff that described me and everything, we had them all down. And chasing was a recurring theme, and extreme was a recurring theme. And then all of a sudden they got put together, and we thought that's perfect.
It made sense. That made sense. The whole chasing does come through when you talk about it.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I want to get into in a moment is just around the whole mental health piece, because I think there's something there that I think some of my listeners can maybe see themselves reflected in it, because I see myself reflected in some of what you describe, the being busy part and not really dealing with your stuff because I've got to do this, now I've got this other thing to do, oh, and I can't slow down now. And every time I talk to, not every time, but quite frequently you talk to somebody, how are you? I'm busy. How are you? I'm busy. Oh, I'm busy. I'm so busy. I'm going to have a heart attack if I'm any more busy, you know. And we're really busy. We're a nation. We're a society of busy people. We're a world of busy people. And I think sometimes that busyness is just, it's that deflection. It's deflecting, asking hard questions of ourselves, having real conversations with people, connecting with the people that are close to you, you know, all of that stuff. And asking that question, who am I? What do I want? A lot of people don't do that work.
I agree. And the funniest thing in the UK, and I, to a degree in Australia, like I went back last year, and but it's more so here, prevalent in the UK, and you can appreciate this, is if someone asks you, like, how are you today, even like someone at the checkout, and you say, oh, I'm great, I've had a really great day, how are you?
Yeah.
They almost fall off their chair. They do. Or if you say to someone in the street, they just ask you because they're being polite or something like that, or even like a friend, if you go, oh, I'm great, it's been awesome, I've had a really great couple of weeks.
Yeah.
They're like, whoa, hang on, calm down a little bit. Like,
flip side is, I had a little bit of an existential crisis last night and I couldn't sleep. You know, and it's like, oh, whoa.
Yeah.
See, I'll see you later then.
So you have this sort of a few answers that's basically nothing answers, as you said, like they don't really want to talk about it. But if you go out of those lines, people sort of freak out. It's like, well, are you asking me just to be polite or do you really want to know? And I make a point, and it's not for anyone else, but it's for myself, because I think framing things in a certain way makes a big difference. Mm. So if people do ask me, how have you been? Like said to you when I first met you earlier today, it was like, yeah, like things have been hectic mm-hmm. because I've had a book and another project be working and coming together. That's honest answer. I'll get bored of that answer in probably another week and people say, how are you? It's like, I'm fantastic. Mm-hmm. I've had a couple of weeks off. I've recovered. I'm feeling great. I'm excited. I've been sleeping really well, eating really well. I'm amazing. And you ask that from someone that say between Christmas and New Year's or even the start of the year and they're like, oh, I've got to go back to work now. I had a good Christmas. I ate too much and I'm just another year now. It's framing things and also looking at things in a broader picture, I feel like, and not just defaulting to an answer that you give all the time rather than actually asking yourself, even pausing and thinking about the question, how are you? And if you stop and you think, actually, I had a really good day, I'm good. You actually say that to someone rather than just go, oh, I'm okay. If they've asked a question, give them a true and honest answer. Even if they don't really want to ask you that question, but they're just doing it to be polite, you can control how you react to that question by giving them a complete, honest answer. And that might be the first step to having complete, open and honest conversation with the other person, because they realize you're being vulnerable by telling them exactly how you feel. Oh, I might do that too. And then when you have an open and honest and complete real conversation, that's when you can learn about another person, even if you think you know them. But that's when beautiful insights about the world and about each other and just having a great conversation, which I don't think many people have anymore, that's when that can happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's about connecting with other human beings. My God, what a novelty, right?
Yeah. Tell me about it.
Let's talk a little bit about your mental health challenges, because it's something that we don't talk about very much, particularly us men. We're told implicitly oftentimes, explicitly other times, that it's not something we should be talking about. We shouldn't be feeling vulnerable. We shouldn't be showing our vulnerability. We shouldn't be saying things like, I'm feeling a little down because blah, 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 or I'm struggling with a bit of anxiety or whatever. That's not something that we're supposed to be talking about.
And unfortunately, it's deemed as weakness.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why I have been so open in my book, Chasing Extreme, about my mental health battles, is because I would like anyone to stand in front of me and say that I'm mentally weak because I suffer from depression and how bad it's been when they've seen the challenges I've done and the things I've put myself through. And it's not the fact that I'm trying to sort of say, well, I'm so tough because I've done this and I've got depression. It's got, having mental health problems or illnesses or issues, it's got nothing to do with how strong you are physically, mentally or emotionally. It's got nothing to do with that. So to label people a weak if they suffer from mental health, but even more so if they talk about mental health or even if they talk about their feelings, to go another extreme way, it's just wrong. Mm-hmm. So I felt like when I came to a point that I felt comfortable speaking about what I went through, because it was the same thing. It's like when I really felt like before I understood what I was going through, I'm like 24, 25 and a professional footballer. Mm-hmm. And I just thought I was a bit down because of, I don't know, we lost a game. And then we won and I still felt the same. Mm. And I got injured, us because I'm injured. But then I got man of the match and I still feel the same. And I was just like, this is weird. Mm. What the hell's going on? Oh, suck it up and get on with it. You're living a perfect life. So this progressed and then I didn't really understand why at times when I couldn't even get out of bed. You know, like Mel Robbins wrote this book. I can't remember the name of it, but it's basically she calls it the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or the 5 pro. I can't remember what it is, but it's basically when you're struggling, you say, right, I'm going to count to 5.
The 5-second rule.
Yeah. And I think that's what it's called. Yeah. So when you get to 1, that's right, you go and do it. So you sort of set yourself up and it's like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. And she's done a lot of research on the science side of this, on the neuroscience type of thing. And like she's really cool to follow and has some really good insights in the books, you know, quite amazing. And I used to do that. I was like, right, okay, and I would visualize and I would process, okay, when I get out of bed, I need to do this, 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 this. And I'm like, okay, so 10, 9, 9, 9, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. And I was like, no, it's not happening. And then it went to really extreme lengths where I was standing on top of bridges at 3 o'clock in the morning, thinking about, is it all worth it? And then at the same time, and this is something that only came out in the book, and I'll tell you why in a minute, that I started to binge eat as well. So I had an eating disorder for several years, and coming from someone who is known to eat extremely clean and who promotes eating real food and nothing processed, you can imagine the inner turmoil I was going through, and I'm stuffing things into my face that aren't healthy and are processed, and I'm hiding that from everyone. So that was a battle as well, and really confusing time. And I realized when I started to go on this journey that years had passed and I'd seen therapists, and I started to open up to family and friends because I realized, battling with insomnia for the best part of 18 months, at its worst, I was getting 6 hours of sleep a week. Sometimes I didn't even get changed or didn't even go to bed. I would just stay in my same clothes and stay in my bedroom and work or watch movies or whatever, and just because I was like, I know if I lay down and it's dark and I'm stuck inside my own head, the demons are just going to batter me, and I'm probably going to go and try and find anything to eat in the kitchen that's just to make me get that dopamine hit. Yes, I've put that in there. Oh, I feel great now. And then it crashed again, and I'm just going to do that during the night. And this is what went on for like 18 months. So then it got to a point where I started to have these feelings of, I can't do this anymore. And it's not like it just changed overnight. This is a period of time when I started to talk about it more to my therapist, and that started to really help me. And so, one of the things I tell people is if you are struggling, talk to people who don't know you. Go and see a therapist, or there's free counselor hotlines now that you can talk. People you can text, and they'll text you back, and they'll text you. You can be whoever you want. You can call your name. You can call yourself Steve. And if your name's Luke, you can make everything up about yourself. But just talk to someone. Be part of a community, whether that's just one person or another group. And you don't even have to talk. You can just be part of it. So that was the first step for me, and I really think that's beneficial for a lot of people.
That's probably the bravest step, because that's probably the hardest step.
100%, because you're getting your thoughts, and potentially, if you're completely honest, what your actions have been, out of your own head and into the world. And that's scary, because you're being vulnerable. And being vulnerable can be very scary if you don't do it regularly. And then it got a point to, I met my wife, Vanda, and I opened up to her. We'd only been dating for about 5 months, and I remember it so clearly. We're just sitting on the couch, and this was like four or five months before the Ultimate Triathlon, and I was on the verge of having another breakdown, and I just opened up to her about what I was going through. And she just said, it's okay. I'm here to support you. And I was just like, I was expecting her to just go, yeah.
Too much information.
Cool. I'll call you tomorrow, see you later, and never see her again. Well, maybe not to that extreme, but that was in my head manifesting that she was just going to have some sort of freak out. Having that support was amazing. And then being able to speak with my family and friends, giving them 75% of the story to start with, that I was battling with mental health. I had a few suicidal thoughts, but, I never really went as far as anything else like that. I didn't tell them that three times I ended up standing on bridges because I thought I'm not ready for that. And then fast forward another sort of 12 months, and I started talking about it to the public. And what really, I guess you could say, what my deep-rooted why was, and what was that driving force, that energy that was really going to push me forward, is I gained that clarity in the fact that at the time I was 32-year-old male who had been a professional athlete, who had done some of these world's most extreme challenges, and I suffered from depression. And I had numerous times wanted to take my life, and I was binge eating and all this type of stuff. And I thought, I can really make a difference here by just being honest and telling my story, telling some of my experiences. And now, I didn't talk about everything, as I said, to the public. I gave that 75%. I told the public that this was my experience and this was the extent of my mental health. I told my family, my mum and my dad and my now wife, I told her that, all of that, but it was, there was still 25% left that I was so ashamed of that I just wasn't ready. And that was part of, that was like the binge eating and the suicidal things that I was going through, standing on top of bridges. I didn't really tell anyone that type of stuff. And then I got to a point where it's just like, I have to be open. And then coming to writing the book was my friend Jane, who we discussed earlier, who helped me sort of take my vomit on a page and turn it into an actual edible meal, as an analogy that we would talk about often. She said to me after the Ultimate Triathlon, like, you should write a book about this. Do you want me to give you a hand? Because she's in sort of the writing world. And I was like, let me send you something. Mm. And because I'd already started writing a book and it was supposed to be about when I returned from Nepal, that was going to be the book, growing up and going to Nepal and doing that, a stereotypical adventure book as my first book. But life happened for about 2 years. Depression, breakup from relationship, battling all this stuff that we just went over, that sort of happened in a 2 year period, and I'd put it down. And then when Jane asked me, do you want to pick it back up or do you want to write a book about this? And I said, well, hang on, here's 80,000 words of a book. Mm. Read that. And I had several adventures in there, and she was just like, wow, this is phenomenal. Can you like fill in the gaps? And I'm like, let me get back to you. And I had to think about this because it was a case of, I could do that 75%. Mm-hmm. I could tell everyone that, right, 75% of my story.
So 25% there.
And it would be really entertaining, mm, and it would be jaw-dropping and it would be insightful, but it wouldn't be real, mm, and it wouldn't be completely honest. So I said to Jane and I said, look, I'm going to be very honest with you. I'm going to shock you with how open I'm going to be, and I'm going to tell you the whole story. And she was like, yeah, okay, sure, didn't really know what that meant. And I said, whatever I send to you, whatever email you, so she lives in Australia, that goes in the book. If I don't email you anything, then you never got it. But if I email you something and I ask you to delete it or I ask you not to use it, don't worry. If I send it to you, it's fair game. Wow. And she was a bit like, yeah, okay, like what? And I said, you'll know. So then when I started to write about this period of my life that I was battling through when I broke up with my girlfriend who I'd planned to move back to Australia with and have kids and picket fence and all that stuff, when that broke down and my insomnia kicked in and my binge eating and my self-harming and, yeah, standing on top of bridges, and I would hit send on an email, and then I'm Googling how to unsend emails because I'm freaking out. Like, this can't be in the book. I can't be this open. Like, people are going to think that I'm a fraud. And, you know, I'm talking about eating real food and I'm binge eating. And, like, I'm freaking out. And I would get a text message from Jane, are you okay? Because then she got it. And then I kept sending all this stuff, stories and instances and how what I was pushing myself through. And then, you know, the whole chasing extreme and chasing and being so extreme in my lifestyle and my thoughts and my actions. We got to a point where she was just like, I'm so proud of you. And we hadn't finished the book. So this is going to make a difference to the world because you're being so open. And that's my deep-rooted whys of talking about my mental health and talking about what I've gone through and being so open in this book. Like, writing it in the way that I wrote it is the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. You can combine all my endurance challenges, all the heartache I've gone through, all my football career, and doesn't even come close, because I literally like opened up my mind for people to see it in real time. That's what happened. That's how open and honest I was. And I have no secrets. I have nothing that I didn't put in that book. So I really felt like I had an opportunity to make a difference in the world by being so open and honest. And the difficult thing for me now is to convince people that the book is not about my adventures and it's more about a personal journey. So that's why I wrote the book and the reasons and the deep-rooted whys of why I wrote it so openly.
Wow. I mean, that must have been so difficult to go through and to challenge. Well, it is a challenge, but it's bigger than a challenge. You're just opening your heart and soul to the world. And there's that thing about, you know, the importance of being vulnerable. But I mean, how do you feel? How do you feel now?
I feel very proud of myself, and this is something that people who know me very, very close. My mum knows me the best out of anyone. We're very close, even though I left the home at 16. They know that I don't say that about myself very often. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm a very energetic person and I love what I do and I've achieved some amazing accomplishments. But to actually sit down and say to myself or say in front of someone else that I'm proud of an achievement, that never happens for me. It never has. Yeah. So I, first and foremost, I'm very proud of how I wrote the book.
Yeah, you should be. Yeah.
And because it wasn't easy.
Yeah.
But also I feel like that I'm doing this for, I'm giving people a voice through my book. And this might sound weird, but if I can change one person's life, if I can help someone think a little bit different about themselves, whether they're struggling with their mental health or something else, or just struggling with overcoming something in their own life, if they read my book and it helps them think in a different way or helps them realize that they're not alone, they're not an outcast, they're not standing out on the ledge by themselves, figuratively, that there are other people who go through this and it's okay. Mm-hmm. You don't have to write a book about it, but it's okay to be you. It's okay to be not perfect in this perfect social media world. It's fine. Just continually to work on yourself daily, to try and take a step. Now, that step can be 1 millimeter forward, or you might be stationary for a day. But as long as your eyes are up and as long as you're trying to be the best version of yourself every single day, then that's all you can do. And it's okay to not be amazing and take huge leaps every day. And the flip side to that, and I think you get this in the book, is if you're trying to be the best version of yourself every single day, which you hear so often, and I've said it a million times, and I almost preach it, the flip side to it that you have to understand is if you don't progress in a day or in a week, if you don't develop, if you're not the best version of yourself that day and you take a step back and you go backwards, it's okay. Do not beat yourself up about it. Just understand what happened, what went wrong, and learn from it. And tomorrow's a new day. Mm-hmm. Can you take a step forward? So it's not beating yourself up if you take a step back, because I beat myself up and you saw the digression that I took, you know, standing on top of bridges and binge eating and not really facing up to the facts.
When you were standing on top of bridges, how long ago was that? Just to put the time frame, is that before the ultimate triathlon?
Before the ultimate triathlon. So the year of was the last time. So it was around sort of 2014, 2015. Okay.
So it's during this period of like really challenging yourself, doing all these extreme challenges.
Not talking about my mental health.
Not talking about your mental health.
Insomnia was at its peak, you know, so my mental framework, my the neurotransmitters on a chemical level, my brains, they were screwed up. They were going all everywhere and I was just not happy. Mm-hmm. So this period of time was the toughest part for me, and I really look at that time in my life where it's like, I know I'm not the only person going through that.
Yeah.
And I know there's people who are going through more extreme things than me, and I know there's people going through things that are less extreme and a little bit more diluted, so to speak. But for them, it's still hell, so to speak. So it's as long as people are trying to just be a little bit better each day and don't beat themselves up if they're not, because they can look on Instagram and go, oh, look at these people having amazing lives and my life sucks and I'm not really progressing in what I'm trying to do. And then all of a sudden they go, oh, I'm not going to do it anymore. And they sort of spiral in a downward way. It's like, if you do take a step back or if you don't progress that day, that week, don't beat yourself up.
Yeah.
Be present, gather yourself and say, okay, tomorrow, what can I do to be better? Simple as that. Look to progress each day, and if you don't beat yourself up about it. Learn from that experience.
It's just beating yourself up twice. I mean, there's the little failure, and then there's the what you're doing, your mindset after that, and it's just you're just adding to it.
100%.
Yeah, I think what's wonderful about what you've done is you've kind of opened up the conversation, and that's what we need. Just in the past year, I've realized I've suffered from anxiety for most of my life. And started to see someone about that, but I hadn't I didn't really realize that. And I'm now in a better place because I can talk to people about that. And we all have these masks, right? There's that book. Actually, Lewis House came out with a book that the mask
of masculinity
is wonderful, right?
Yeah,
because
it's a great
we
book.
All wear the. I mean, I went through that list and I'm like, yeah, wore that one, wore that one, wore that one, got same. That one. And we all do that, and we're denying ourselves like our humanity, right? We're just human beings, so we should just talk to one another more like human beings.
Yeah, it's like as you said, like it's. Opening up that conversation like you just did, and thanks for thanks for sharing that. You've been battling with anxiety.
It took an acute crisis.
Yeah,
you know,
most of the time it does.
And it was just sort of, and then like dealt with the aftermath of that crisis. But then I realized, like, oh wait a minute, I felt like this for years, and I didn't really know what it was. I hadn't really talked to anyone about it, and I wouldn't have gone to. I mean, even if a friend, like when you talked about. Seeing someone, right? If you have a problem, like an injury, you want to see a doctor, right?
Yeah.
You're not gonna, you might say, "Oh, cheer up" or whatever. Your friends mean well, but you need to see someone that knows what they're talking about.
No, 100%. And for me, now I'm 35. I always forget my age. Sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down. As a 35-year-old male who does these big extreme adventures. And used to be a professional footballer and has bounced all around the world and had looks on the surface of have had and having an amazing life. You know, I'm speaking around the world as well. That I had this opportunity to actually open the conversations.
Yeah.
Because, okay, like, there aren't many 35-year-olds who have opened up. You know, the males, you know, because...
There aren't many 45 and 55 and 65 and so on.
And because I'm young, that I feel like that I can still relate to people who are younger than me, to a younger generation, to, the full-blown millennials and even younger. Because I do this cool, crazy adventure stuff, and because I have been a professional athlete, I can hang with the cool kids for 5 minutes. So, and that's about it. But it's, I don't feel obliged. There's no pressure, but I feel like I have an opportunity. And when I feel like I have an opportunity, it's like I want to take that opportunity because, as I said to you, every single day, if I can change someone's life, then I've done my job. Mm-hmm. Every talk that I do, I don't care if I talk in front of thousands of people like I have done or a small group like I did the other day, 12 people. Mm. I only need to sort of drop an ounce of inspiration or thought or something to think about in one person. And it's like, my job's done.
Mm.
You know, I'd love to do it for everyone, but I just want someone to think a little bit more about how they're feeling or how they can progress.
Yeah, and we live in a, it's cliche, interconnected, whatever, networked world, whatever. But, that person, if you think of him as a node on a network, he's got his network. And so he'll spread that, right? Mm-hmm. And it goes out. So, you change one life, shifted one mindset, and it spreads. So it's very powerful.
That's the plan. And now that, I do have a book out, people who like to read... it's on Kindle as well, if you don't like paperbacks, audio coming out next year. And, I do have this documentary out as well and all this other stuff online. Is I have resources that I can send people to, and people can find me in different communities, So I love that about being connected with the world because people can find me and I can find more people.
What's interesting is also when you set out like, well, why did you do this, these extreme events and I want to be this adventurer athlete. And maybe at the time I'm just kind of putting thoughts or words into, the Luke Taberski of that era, that you thought, well, people will think I'm cool or they'll be sort of like, and now it's given you. Well, maybe that's whatever.
You thought you would be cool, right? That's all I cared about. I thought this would be cool to do, and I would be cool.
But actually, it's given you this a bit of this kind of other gift, which is it's given you this platform,
100%.
And that's what it's done. It's less less that you can think of yourself as cool, but I think of you as cool, but
I think I'm cool.
you're cool. But that's the real power is not that. The real power is to actually this is hey, wait a minute. Here's a guy who's done all this stuff. So but he's also very open about his struggles with mental health and depression. And it's okay to talk about this, you know, and that's really, I think, the gift that's given you.
Yeah, because if someone looks at me and go, well, if he's done all these big endurance challenges and he's been an athlete and...
You know, you wouldn't call this guy a weak snowflake or
exactly.
Like that.
It's like, well, if he can talk about that, like, even if it just changed the way that people think for a start, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Because then maybe one day they'll talk to their spouse or their sibling or their best friend and say...
You should look this guy up.
You should look this guy up. And you know what? Like, he battles with depression. And then all of a sudden that conversation started.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden it's like, yeah, like some of the stuff he's gone through, I feel like I've gone through. Have you ever thought like that? And they're using me as a medium to connect between like your friend or your spouse. Or like, because that's happened. Like, I've been told that's happened with my story and people who have met me at different events. And like, that's what gets me excited. And that's what fuels me.
Mm.
Yeah, that's like the fertilizer to my tree, to my deep-rooted whys, is hearing the difference I've made in people's lives. Mm-hmm. It doesn't do anything to my ego. It's like, right, so how can I help more people?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, cool, like I'm getting a bigger profile and whatever. It's like, right, that gets me so pumped up, so excited. How can I try and do this for more people? I want more people to start thinking about how I can be open, how I can be vulnerable, and how I can grow every single day and be the best version of myself. But at the same time, it's like, it's okay not to be perfect. It's okay to fail. It's okay to take a backward step. But then I'm going to try and take that next step forward the following day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what really gets me excited.
Yeah, that's awesome. And there's also something about being able to see the results of your work that's powerful. And I work in kind of a corporate space, and I see that a lot of people, they don't have that. And many people that work like in an office or work in kind of knowledge work or whatever, they don't see, it's like an input and an output. You don't see that. You kind of, you do your work, but you're not really sure what difference is it making, you know, in the big picture, in the big scheme of things. And that's why I think a lot of people that work in kind of a professional sense are unhappy with where they are.
No, I totally agree. Community is massive. You know, it's huge that it's a support system, but it's almost like this circle that never ends, because you can lean one way and someone's there to support you, but then you can prop someone up on the other side of you. So it's like this cyclical support system. But it's when you're lonesome and you're by yourself and there's no one right next to you, if you need help, you've got no one there.
Yeah.
And if you need to help someone, you can't, because there's this gap. You know, so like in a corporate setting, you've got your cubicle, literally. You can't sort of like, if you try and talk to someone right next to you, there's this wall.
Yeah.
And if someone needs your help, there's this wall.
Yeah.
You know, so I feel like, you know, breaking down those barriers and really being part of different communities in whatever you do can help. You can get support, but then also you can support others.
Yeah.
And it's that whole cyclical motion where you're leaning one way but then helping someone next to you at the same time. And I think that helps everyone move forward.
I think there's something really powerful in that. And I was talking to I had Hilary Gallo on recording another episode. He wrote a book called The Fear Hack, and he used to be this corporate negotiator. And he talks about the importance of having an enabling environment. So what that is really, you know, when things are win-win.
Yep.
And how powerful that is. And a lot of us work in places where it's like a non-win-win. It's a win-lose kind of environment where we have that mindset. And when you shift it, it's really, really, it's incredibly powerful. There's a reason why breakaways in cycling often fail, right? The guy goes off at the front. Usually the peloton comes and swallows them up. You know, it's better to work together. We've covered quite a lot of ground here. I did want to touch on any of your most recent challenges or your future challenges and what you've kind of, maybe we didn't really talk about the 500 man, even though I had the honor of joining you for a little bit of the 500 man.
Yeah, you did.
I'm keen to just hear what are some of your challenges and why do you do them? And how different is that from what you've done before
in the past
in terms of motivation?
So now I've learned a lot from that
18 months of stopping and reflecting, and this year was all about getting the book out. I did the 500 man, and unfortunately...
And tell my listeners what the 500 man is.
It was a 500 kilometer non-stop triathlon, so swimming 10 kilometers in a lake, cycling 390 kilometers, and then running, finishing with a 100 kilometer run. Now, it sounds ridiculous and it's crazy, and I failed, heads up, didn't do it, got pulled out by the crew. I think I got pulled out about 130, 40 kilometers from the bike, didn't finish the bike, and then I had a 3-hour nap and then did 25 kilometers on the run and got pulled out.
You did 25 kilometers on the run?
Yeah. Yeah. Context, it was the second hottest day in the UK, which anyone who doesn't live in the UK and thinks of hot days in the UK, it was only 34 degrees. Yeah. But it's the UK is... You're not built for 34 degrees if you live here. It's quite extreme.
It's also humid.
Yeah, it's very humid. We were cycling in the middle of the day. We got on the bike at 10:30. So I was swimming in a wetsuit.
It's like almost no cloud cover that day.
There's no cloud cover. The bitumen was just bouncing heat off, hitting us in the face from underneath. I started the swim early, got out of there, swam in a wetsuit, which I'm just used to and I was always going to, but that probably overheated me a little bit. And then I think it was just a downward spiral from then. Ended up with heat stroke, couldn't really eat, dry reaching, was not in a good way. So when I do these challenges, I normally have a crew. I'm a little bit more lenient if I'm doing them by myself. Most of my really, truly extreme challenges are when I do them by myself because there's no parachute, there's no one to pull me out. But my crew chief was my wife, who's also an osteopath. Amongst other things, so she's very intelligent about the human body, and she was part of my crew for the ultimate triathlon in a smaller role. But she pulled me out on the bike because I was not in a great way, suffering from heat stroke. So people that don't know, you're nauseous, you can't eat, you can't drink, you're shivering with cold with goosebumps, but you're radiating heat like a radiator. So I've got ice packs on my neck when I'd stop to eat, and then I'd have a big blanket around me to keep me warm because I'm freezing, dry reaching at the time. So she was just like, you're not safe to cycle. It'd just gone dark. I still had like 100 miles or 160Ks, 50Ks
to
go.
Totally right call. Totally.
And she was just like, no, you're not safe to cycle.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. Like we had a emotion put to the side conversation afterwards. When she pulled me out and I said, I don't think you should have. And she said, well, I would do it again in a heartbeat. And I was like, well, I wouldn't have you as my crew chief again. And like, if we should have recorded that conversation because there's no way anyone would have believed we were husband and wife and have the relationship that we have, which is just very loving and so caring. But I said to her, I said, I want to put emotions to the side. And she's the type of person that can do that. So can I. Mm-hmm. It's nothing personal. It's just this is my belief. And I still believe to this day that she should let me cycle because I've cycled in a lot worse state. But anyway, so I got pulled out from that. And then,
for the record, I think she made the right call.
And then... Obviously, I went back. I had like a 3-hour nap and then I had a little bit of food and then went out running. And the plan was to do 100Ks. But initially, it was 25Ks. So 12.5Ks out on the towpath next to the River Thames and then back to my house and then up into Richmond Park and do laps where I had about probably 40 people who were going to come and meet me. After I got back to the house after 25Ks, I laid down on the ground. The heat stroke was just flaring up because by this stage, it was about 8 o'clock and about 28 degrees. It was quite hot again that day. I had ice on me. I was shivering and all the rest of it. And she just said, no, you're done. We're calling the ambulance because then I was struggling with my breathing. I couldn't take deep breaths. So that freaked her out. Jeez. Understandably, to a degree, I still think she should have let me keep going. But as I said, we've had that conversation. We agree to disagree and we've moved on. And when we put the emotions back in, we gave each other a hug and we said we love you, each other, love each other. And that was it. That was really cool. But now, to put it into perspective, the reason why I did this, it's not because I needed to do a 500-kilometer triathlon for my ego. I've already done one. You know, a double Ironman is 400 and... Well, the double Ironman I did was 475 kilometers. okay, it's not 500, but it's 475. But the kicker is I did it in North Wales and with 4,000 metres of climbing on the bike and 3,000 metres of climbing on the run. The 500 man, I found the flattest route as possible. So people have said, oh, it was a little bit too tough for you or it was too long. Like, are you going to do it again? Or are you disappointed that you didn't do it? And I was like, it's got nothing to do with the distance. I know I can do the distance. I've done it before. It was unfortunate that the heat of the day, it was unfortunate that I, well, fortunate to a degree that I had speaking engagements in Hong Kong only 2 weeks before the event, and I flew 12 and a half hours for 4 days and flew 12 and a half hours back, and that was 2 weeks. I don't really think I recovered all that well from that. And that's what I put it down to. Not excuses, just in reality, that's what I put it down to. And it was the heat, and probably didn't quite manage the heat as well as I could have. Probably should have dumped loads of ice down my jersey to try and cool the core temperature, maybe swim without a wetsuit on in the lake. This is all just real reasons and what I've learned from the experience. But the reason why I did the 500 man, I know this is a very long-winded reason why, but with context, it was because I wanted to do this communal challenge. Yeah, we talked about this on the bike, is how often do you see these big challenges cross lakes, cross oceans, cross countries where you can't actually go and interact with these people? Or if you want to, they're in really remote places. I wanted to do something where people would come and join me where I'm in the middle of it. And it didn't matter like how good of a cyclist you were or how fit you were. I told people, I'm going to be cycling around this pace. Mm. It's dead flat. If you're not quite up to that standard, you'll be okay. You can jump on the back and we'll wait for you a little bit. Like my mate Pete, he came along. He wasn't quite as good a cyclist as what we were. He hung on for a little bit at the back. He bounced off a little bit. We slowed down occasionally. We stopped for drink breaks. He jumped on and it was fine. I wouldn't have cycled any faster. It was just, you know, and he had a great time. He cycled further than he had done in ages. So that's what it was all about. So we had in total about 6 or 7 people over the day come and join us on the bike. And as I said, there's about 40 people who were going to come and join us on the run. And that's what it was about, having people to come and join me and see what it's like. And I had this vision where I think we spoke about it a bit, and I spoke about it with Mike, who came and did the run with me in the morning. He drove like 2.5 hours to do the 100K run with me, landed at my house at 4 o'clock in the morning and saw me in my bed. He's like, I don't think we're going to be running at all. But we still did 25Ks. And I had this vision that I'm struggling and I'm in a really, really dark place. And someone comes up to me and goes, Luke, I want to know what you're thinking right now and how you are still going. Because I felt like that was an opportunity to share the knowledge that life has taught me during these big challenges with people who are fresh, but I'm not, and how am I still cycling? How am I still running? And I felt like I did that to the few people that were with me at different times, and that was one of the deep-rooted whys of why I wanted to do it, was not only be communal, but I wanted people to see me struggling, but then they could talk to me and I could share with them what I was dealing with and how I'm going to keep pushing forward. So that was the 500 man.
It's a great idea.
Yeah.
If you can do it again, replicate it or do something similar. I love the idea of sharing the journey, parts of the journey with other people. I think that's fabulous.
Yeah, and there are certain things that I want to do in the future where I can do that. Yeah, training. The other thing, training for a 500-kilometer triathlon, it takes time.
It does.
Yeah, and training for any sort of triathlon takes time because you've got 3 sports. And I sort of already had 2019 planned at the start of 2018. I like to work in sort of 2-year, potentially 3-year cycles, because when you do these big challenges, they take time.
Yeah.
And for me, now this is my business because, you know, I had 4 brands who invested in the 500 man. And we had a videographer there that made a mini documentary, which is coming out between Christmas and New Year's, because we just finished the filming, so the reflection piece the other week. So he's putting that together, Physique Media, and a little shout out to him. And so I had brands on board. So that was another way that I can make income from doing these big challenges where brands get on board and I write magazine articles for I had different articles, bit different magazines who said, yeah, like you do it, then you can write about it. Triathlon magazines, obviously I didn't do it, so I didn't write the articles, but these are small ways where I can make a little income from doing these big challenges. Don't get me wrong, like I pitched to brands and media outlets all the time. They're like, not interested, not interested. But the 500 man stuck with people because it was communal, because we had a videographer coming along and it was going to work great. Mm-hmm. So to do it again, like, would I say I'd do it again? If I find a time in a year over the next few years, then I would. But it's not something that I'm like, I'm focused on, because I've already got other things planned coming up for next year.
Yeah. Such as?
I'm having a summer holiday. I'm having a summer holiday in Ireland.
Okay.
I've never been.
Okay.
Okay, I've never been to Ireland. And I thought, you know what? I've heard it can be pretty nice in summer. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I'm going to go over there and have a little summer holiday. And I thought, for me, the best way to see a large portion of Ireland is to run from the most southern point to the most northern point and check out the scenery.
Uh-huh.
So that's what I'm doing in the summer next year. That's sort of my, I'm going to say potentially my biggest challenge for the year. It's about 650 kilometers the route I take, maybe 700.
Okay.
I'll do it in 9 to 10 days, depending on how fit I feel leading up to it.
Okay.
And I'm doing it self-supported. Not self-supported as I have a film crew with me, and do I stay in hotels or do I sleep at Ruff or whatever. I'm literally taking a backpack, some food, a sleeping bag, a bivy bag, and that's it.
Jeez.
I've got my route planned, and I'll fuel up at different towns as I go through. I'm not planning on sleeping in any hotels. I'm just going to go proper adventure.
So you're not having a crew?
No crew, just me, man.
Whoa.
As I said, it's my summer holiday.
Wow.
My summer holiday. My wife's not interested. She'd do it by herself. So that's it. So I'm going to
Are you going to be tracking?
I'll have a tracker. I'll do social media stuff so people can come along with me. I am potentially going to make my own little mini self-filmed film so people can see what it's like. Take my GoPros along with me and do bits and pieces. It might just be something that I chuck on YouTube and it's not all that exciting because of whatever reason, but you know, maybe it is cool. I'll get the guys at Physique Media to try and work some magic and edit it down, but I'll be there by myself filming it. There's no one else with me. I thought it's a great way to spend some time for the first time in Ireland and have a little summer holiday.
Cool.
Yeah. So that's potentially the biggest thing for next year. I've got a couple of 100K races and there may be something big, big, big at the end of the year, but that's still keeping that under my hat.
All right,
because
all right.
I'm still,
don't ask too much about that.
Still speaking with a few people that are potentially going to make that happy and happen, and that's could be
so
massive.
Would that, just to ask a little bit about that, is that a running, biking, swimming thing, or is that something new, or...?
All I can say is it's the longest thing I've ever done over the most days, and it's in a way that is brutal. That's all I can give you.
All right.
That's all I can give you.
Okay. We'll stay tuned for that. I think we covered a lot of ground here. So, but was there anything that we didn't mention that you'd like to?
I just want to reinforce that notion that I said was like, if we can be present in each moment of every day and just try and put those moments together to build our day and try and be just one little step better in any aspect of life. It doesn't have to be every aspect of life. Just one, like, even if it's in your marriage or in your work life or in your for your health. If you can just try and be a little bit better every day in one of those, not all of them, just in one of those, then you're going to progress. And remember, if you don't beat yourself up about it. Know that tomorrow's a new day. You know, you live in the moment of the day, you learn from the past, and you can plan for the future. But that's it. As long as we're living in each moment of every single day, then we are truly living. And just continually try and be better. A little bit better. Doesn't have to be a big jump, just a little bit. And do not beat yourself up if you have taken a step back or you've fallen off the wagon, so to speak. And talk about how you're feeling. You know, just to go along the lines of the topics that we've discussed. But you know, if you want a cool story, obviously check out the book Chasing Extreme. I'm going to have a massive plug here.
Yeah, go for it. Plug away, man.
The documentary is The Ultimate Triathlon Documentary, very original name there. It's on Amazon, so you can check that out. That will blow your mind. And if you have watched the documentary, the three chapters in Chasing Extreme, the book, are very different. I literally wrote the chapters for Chasing Extreme while watching the documentary. Because...
How was that as an experience, watching yourself doing this thing?
Oh, well, it was fine, because this sounds completely narcissistic. Every time I'm asked this question or I answer it in this way, it just sounds so narcissistic, because I've watched the documentary about 40 times. You know? But you've got to remember, I've been to about 30 screenings.
Yeah, of course.
So watching in the crowd before I do a Q&A. And, you know, in the lead up to before we launched it, I watched it and we, you know, we tweaked, you know, 30 seconds of footage or 10 seconds of footage or cut this or cut that. So it's not just like I've sat down on my a big screen TV and watched it. So I, like, there's a period of time where I just knew everything that was happening in the film. And I said to myself before I sat down to write the Ultimate Triathlon chapters in the book Chasing Extreme was, I don't want to retell that story, because that 90 minutes that is the film, that's that story that's on the film. The Ultimate Triathlon was 12 days. So much stuff happened that the film crew captured that's not in the film. But then I didn't have a film crew in front of me the entire 12 days. They leapfrogged ahead. We lost one another. I was asleep. I was getting breakfast or when they weren't there. My mind was going 12 days, 24 hours a day, pretty much, to a degree. It was the part in the documentary where my mind wasn't going, and I'll let people figure that out for themselves. But so many thoughts and so many things happened that didn't just make it in front of the camera or make it in the final cut. And it was, there's a few big things in the documentary that obviously I had to bring into the book, but it was like watching that, it's like, I don't want to tell that story. That was almost like, okay, so remember that one climb when the crew wasn't there and you were yelling and screaming and swearing at yourself and you just hated it and you didn't want to do it anymore? Right, tell that story. You know, why were you thinking like that? What got you through that? You know, because then that carried on from the rest of the book. So it was really simple, actually, if I'm honest, because the Ultimate Triathlon documentary told the story from the filmmaker's perspective. And I told the story of the Ultimate Triathlon from my perspective. And although on the surface they are very similar, but they are two very, very, very different stories. So it was quite simple. So I've had half a dozen people who have read the book who are close to me and have just said, I was concerned you were just going to say the same thing in the chapters in the book, but it was really cool. And the most amazing thing was, I saw Physique Media, same guys, I've worked with them quite a lot. They made the documentary. He was over at my house filming for the 500 Man documentary finishing off on the weekend. And he finished the book. He said, I finished the book. He said, but I did this thing I shouldn't have. And I was like, what's that? I started at the Ultimate Triathlon. He said, I couldn't wait. And he just went off on this. I loved it. I learned so much about the 12 days from your side of things, and I didn't capture this, I didn't know that happened. And it was really amazing for the guy who filmed, edited and created the documentary to then read it in the book, to then be blown away and excited about telling the story and learning stuff from it. I knew that I captured the story from my perspective when he told me that. So it's very different. And yeah, that's another thing that I really was conscious about, that people who may have heard my story or may have heard different adventures, I didn't want to just write the same thing over again. So yeah, the documentary is very different to the book. And yeah, just come and check me out on social media. I'm at Luke Tversky. I'm very easy to find. LukeTversky.com is the website. If you live in the UK and you want a signed copy of Chasing Extreme, go to the website, click on the books tab, and you'll click on the British flag or buy now, and it'll take you to a place where you can get a signed copy.
Before we go, I did make a little note when you were just talking about that that moment during the Ultimate Triathlon. What do you think about? What do you say to yourself when you're struggling? Just for somebody out there who might be struggling.
I go back to knowing why you're doing what you're doing. And if it's struggling for something like mentally, you know, like what's your life philosophy? Why are you living life? And if you don't have one, that's a great opportunity to then create one. Okay, so I really fall back on this knowing your why. You know, I resonate. I went through this whole why process and whatever before I found Simon Sinek. And I was just like, dude, we are brothers from another mother. Yeah, he takes it on slightly more business way where I sort of take it on an athletic way, but we meet in the middle with like personal growth. And I've read his book numerous times. And I remember I was reading it one time and I'm like smiling and nodding my head. And my wife's like, what are you doing? And I'm just like, I swear I wrote this. So, yeah, I really feel like it goes back to that. And if you don't have a why, it's a great opportunity to create one.
Fabulous. I think that's a great way to wrap it up.
I love it, man.
Awesome. Thank you so much once again, Luke. This was great. And wish you all the best. And I look forward to all the challenges, including the mystery one that you hinted at.
Yeah, me too. Thanks very much for having me on.
Thank you. Thank you. All the best.
Cheers.
Right. I thought that was awesome. And I hope you did too. Check out Luke and his book, Chasing Extreme. Check out his speaking engagements and much more. Links are all in the show notes. And once again, if you'd like to meet us both, I'll be running the 46 in 219 in London on February the 17th. That's a 46-kilometer run. Luke will be joining me and more than likely helping me get through the tough final few kilometers. And also consider a donation to either Mind, the Battersea Dogs and Cats Home, or Doctors Without Borders. Links to all of that are in the show notes. And finally, if you've not subscribed yet to All Things Risk, please do so. Allthingsrisk.co.uk is the best place to do that. That's it. We'll be back with another episode in 2 weeks. Until then, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.